Sometimes there are only questions. On July 17, 1956, the Milwaukee Braves were hosting the New York Giants at County Stadium. The Giants' starting pitcher was Ruben Gomez, a star in Puerto Rico who had come to the majors and become something of a star here too, winning 13 games his rookie year and 17 with a 2.88 ERA in his second. He started and won a World Series game that year too. He was a right-handed screwballer, which was kind of cool, and he also had a good fastball and a slider, a curve, depending on what you read. And this is important. He wasn't a guy who shied away from pitching inside or risking fights with high and tight pitches. He didn't hit a lot of guys, at least not in the statistical record, but there were a number of troubling fights that resulted from him hitting or dusting batters. In 1953, he hit Dodgers right fielder Carl Furillo, which ignited a massive brawl that saw Furillo break his hand. He hit Frank Robinson in the head and put him in the hospital. And he even fought his own teammate, Willie Mays, at one point, although they later said that that had been more playful than angry. But whatever the case, this was not a guy who shied away from confrontation or from using his pitches to establish his dominance on the mound. Sort of. This day, July 17th, 56, was an exception. The Braves had scored a couple of runs off of Gomez in the bottom of the first, and when the Braves came up to take their turn at bat in the bottom of the second, Gomez was apparently still a little annoyed by that. The leadoff hitter that inning was first baseman Joe Adcock. He's a player who continues to fascinate even though he hung him up way back in 1966. He was one of the great power hitters. His career 336 home runs doesn't sound like a lot now, but at the time he retired it was fairly high up on the list, and the total fails to convey the fact that he got hurt a lot, including for reasons we're about to discuss here, and that periodically various Braves managers would get it in their head that he needed to be platooned or rested for players who weren't nearly his equal in skill, like Joe Torre's older brother Frank. As a result, there are a lot of 300s in the at-bat column on his baseball card that could have been 500s, and if they were 500s, well, he would have put up 30 home runs annually without much of a struggle. When the game in question took place, he was in the midst of what would be the best hitting season of his career. On the season, he hit 291 and slugged about 600 with 38 home runs, and he tended to have huge days. Most famously, in 1954, he had a game at Little Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, in which he went 5-for-5 with 7 RBIs and 5 runs scored, including a double and 4 home runs, which set a record for total bases in a game at the time. He had other days like that, too. In fact, he had one in 1956, which I'll get to in a second. It's kind of the coda to this story. He had come into the July 17th game crazy hot. In July of 56, he had a Giancarlo Stanton month, the kind of month that Stanton's having now. He hit 358 with 15 home runs in 30 games, and in the 8 games heading into the game in question, he had gone 9-for-27 with 7 home runs. This was a guy who was on fire. He also, by reputation, tended to dig in, crowd the plate. He was a big guy, 6'4", 210, at least according to the official statistics. And so it wasn't unusual for him to get brushed back. Just as Gomez didn't hit a lot of people, Adcock didn't get hit a lot, just 17 times in a 17-year career. And yet, if you read the coverage of him when he was an active player, you'd think the guy was a human pincushion. And I suspect the reason for that is that on the few occasions he actually was hit, it was a very memorable event. So back to the top of the second inning. Gomez threw one inside, and it nailed Adcock on the wrist. There are pictures of him cradling his arm. It wasn't broken or anything, but as he trotted down to first, he was pretty angry. That's where those memorable prior events come into play. Remember that record-setting 18 total base day I mentioned from 1954? Well, in the next game, the Dodgers hit Adcock in the head. Later that year, Don Newcomb of the Dodgers hit Adcock in the hand, breaking his thumb and ending his season. The following July, in 1955, Giants pitcher Ed Hearn hit him on the wrist and broke it, ending his season after 84 games. Further, the Giants, who had been managed by Leo Durocher for the previous 7 years, were known as a head-hunting ball club, although what's interesting about that is that they didn't put up crazy high hit-by-pitch totals at that time. Sal Magley, the famous barber, never led the National League in hit batters. And on reflection, I wonder if that doesn't prove anything. The real headhunters, as opposed to the psychopaths and guys who are actually wild and can't control what they're doing, are so good with their command that they rarely do actually hit anybody. They just shave them a bit, like a barber, who comes close with his blades but doesn't cut. So Adcock likely has some or all of this history on his mind as he's trotting down to first base, and he says some rude things to Gomez. Gomez said some rude things back. whatever they were sufficiently provocative to spur Adcock into action. He turns at first base and goes running for the mound, head down. As I said, 6'4", 210 at least, this is an imposing specimen to be charging at you on the mound. Gomez, by the way, 4 inches shorter, 40 pounds lighter. Still, Gomez was typically all for this kind of thing, so what he did next doesn't seem like it's in character. Seeing Adcock, he took the baseball and threw it at him and hit him a second time, this time on the thigh. That wouldn't be sufficient to stop a charging rhinoceros, which was pretty much what Adcock was at that point, so Gomez, realizing he was right out of bullets, turns and runs like hell, making for the Giants' dugout. Now the entire Braves team is charging in from the outfield, from the infield, in pursuit of Gomez, trying to cut him off from reaching the safety of the clubhouse. Simultaneously, all the Giants on the field, all the umpires, and the occasional policemen are also charging for the Giants' dugout, trying to intercept the Braves. Gomez made it. He hadn't covered himself in glory, and the umpires and the cops managed to sort things out before a huge riot erupted. Gomez had to be escorted by policemen from the clubhouse back to the team hotel to ensure his safety. But one thing that's in all subsequent tellings of this story, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, it's not in any of the newspaper reports, is that Gomez ran all the way to the clubhouse and then came back to the dugout to continue the fight, this time holding an ice pick in his hand. That wasn't noted by the National League when they handed down their punishments for this event. Gomez got a 3-game suspension and a $250 fine. Adcock was just fined $100, wasn't suspended at all. His only comment was, "I've never been so mad in all my life." Once Adcock had cooled down, when reporters asked if he expected Gomez to apologize to him, he said, "I don't know. Maybe I should apologize to him." Gomez said, "I saw him coming at me, so I threw the ball at him. I ran away because I didn't want him to break my ribs." So as I said, I have questions. First of all, what did Adcock and Gomez say to each other that got them both so worked up? Second, why did Gomez run away when he typically relished a fight? Third, what made him assume that Adcock was going to go for his ribs? When baseball fights break out, you don't typically see players thinking, "Work the body," as if Burgess Meredith's character from Rocky was coaching them from just outside the ring. They just swing away in not particularly any strategic fashion. Finally, what the hell was an ice pick doing in the visitors' clubhouse at Milwaukee County Stadium? And would Gomez have really punctured a player on a major league ball field? I suppose we'll never know. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "It is better to be violent if there is violence in our hearts than to put on the cloak of nonviolence to cover impotence." Gomez managed to do all of the above? One last note, if you like small, wholesome-style payback. The day after the game, Adcock went 2-for-4 with 2 RBIs and a run scored against the Giants, and then, in the final game of the series, he had one of those Joe Adcock days. 4-for-4, a double, 2 home runs, 8 RBIs. Naturally, Braves manager Fred Haney gave his last at-bat of the day to Frank Torre. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. "What's the name of this bed and breakfast?" you say to Evan Rude. "The Alamo," Evan Rude replies, not even looking up from his guidebook. "Well, wait," you say, "if it's a bed and breakfast, why are all those fellas with guns walking around on the roof?" "You ask so many questions," says Evan Rude. "How about that army camped across the way there?" "Local color," says Evan Rude. Accepting his explanation, you enter the building. You are greeted by an odd maitre d' who identifies himself as Colonel Travis and requests that you take the first watch. "Welcome, Congressman Crockett," he says. "Who's Congressman Crockett?" you say. "My name is Gorovitz." "Funny joke, Congressman Crockett," Colonel Travis says. "Here's your gun." And so you find yourself not at the Holiday Inn, but atop a crumbling mission as all the soldiers in the world run screaming towards you, waving pictures of your mother. You scream, shocking yourself awake, and you realize you shouldn't have watched all those Disney Channel Fess Parker reruns before bed. Time to take that pill that Dr. Ephraim prescribed for you, the one that prevents you from having psychotic delusions about heroic congressmen. With a feeling of deep relief, you reach for a bottle labeled Episode 19. Damn, you think. But I looked good in that coonskin cap. Welcome back to the show. Before we move on, just in the interest of honesty, and to give you a glimpse of what my daily life is like, I just want to share with you that last bit as it actually occurred. You see, my big 20-pound black and white cat Mickey was helping me do some recording tonight. Let's go back to the end of the little reverie you just heard.
Feeling deep relief, you reach for a bottle labeled Episode 19.
Damn, you think. But I looked good in that coonskin cap. Ladies and gentlemen, the joy of being a cat owner. We have... I almost said the cliche. We have a really great show for you tonight. But no, let's not go all show business. It's just me, and the whole enterprise is spectacularly humble. But we do have one hugely above average component in that this week's guest is Meg Rowley of Baseball Prospectus, a writer of columns I quite enjoy, generally about the more whimsical aspects of the game, though indeed she was the 2017 Sabre Award winner for Best Contemporary Commentary. And she also writes insightfully about many of the game's off-the-field controversies, and she recently hosted a landmark event with the Seattle Mariners, celebrating women in baseball, which was a panel discussion featuring several women, whether from the media side or the front office side, who have carved out a niche in baseball. And that was simultaneously the goal and the appeal, to just show you that they were there, so you knew what was possible. If you want to watch it before proceeding with the discussion, and I'll repeat this at the end of the show just in case you decide not to now, you can view it at the Seattle Mariners Facebook page on the video tab. Before Meg comes along, I want to talk to you about a pitcher, a great pitcher, who was born almost 141 years ago and died 103 years ago at the age of 37, named Rube Waddell. Waddell was a very strange character. There was something off about him compared to how we classify normality of emotion or thought. There was something wrong, but there was also something very, very right. Keep that in mind as we continue. Like most Americans, it's been hard for me to tear my thoughts away from the disaster down in Texas, the flooding brought on by Hurricane Harvey, which has reached almost biblical proportions. They've obliterated every American record for rainfall, not just in the state of Texas, not just in the month of August, but just rainfall period. Even if you're a faraway observer, or are so narrow mentally that you're only concerned as a baseball fan. This is the most trivial of things, but the hurricane even affects that with the arguments over the relocation of various Astros games. But what's really striking beyond the extent of the disaster and the suffering that has occurred because of it is how familiar it all is. I've lived through some of the more intense versions of these storms that, from time to time, but perhaps with increasing frequency, make their way up north, even if they're not a patch on the kind that come directly from the Gulf of Mexico onto the continental United States. And I also married into a family of Mississippians, so I've gotten to meet and talk with many people who have experienced some of these historic storms and the humanitarian disasters that resulted from them. It's striking how unprepared we always are, how next time we swear we will be prepared, but when next time comes, it's just like the first time, every time. And there's no indication that this time Hurricane Harvey will change anything. I was just reading the Washington Post. This was published on August 29th, and I quote, "Congress is likely to approve a Harvey recovery bill, as it has after past disasters, to cover the huge cost of storm damages. The cuts proposed by the administration would slice away funding for long-term preparedness efforts, many of them put in place to address the sluggish federal response to Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The proposed cuts would include programs run by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which helps rebuild homes, parks, hospitals, and community centers, the National Weather Service, which forecasts extreme storms, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, whose research and community engagement helps coastal residents prepare for disaster. So, like I said, nothing will change until the next time. And if you're familiar with what happened with Katrina, when doctors were euthanizing elderly patients they couldn't move out of the flooded hospitals, you know just how bad it can get. So in defiance of nature, we'll take away some money and make it harder for people to recover this time or to deflect the next time. Rube Waddell, there was something very, very wrong with him. And yet he knew you don't do that. You don't make it harder on people, or harder on yourself for that matter, in an emergency.
You roll up your sleeves and you pitch in. Rube lived to help people. No one exactly knew what his motives were or why he enjoyed it so much, but he did. And he lived and he died for that, in circumstances very much like those now. I could fill a couple of hours with a full biography of him, but suffice it to say that, as a pitcher, he was peak Randy Johnson or Sandy Koufax, and he put up their kinds of strikeout totals, 300 strikeouts and more, at a time when batters were too busy bunting to strike out very much at all. As I've suggested, as a man, he was damaged somehow. You can almost see it in his formal portraits. His eyes pierce you in a way that's a little uncomfortable. What was wrong with him defied diagnosis at the time, and if we had him here, maybe we could figure it out with modern techniques, but failing that, it's impossible to know. Alcoholism definitely had something to do with it, but drunk or sober, he seemed to have no impulse control, getting himself into fights with teammates or fans in the stands, hopping the train for the coast in the middle of a series in Milwaukee, eventually turning up as a referee of a boxing match or as one of the boxers themselves, or tending bar in a saloon, or playing fullback on the local football team or goalie for the local soccer team. Who even knew Americans played soccer in 1900? And on one occasion when they couldn't find him, he was located under the stands shooting marbles with kids. And he reportedly greatly resented being dragged away from that to go pitch a major league ball game. A lot of times he just took off to go fishing, particularly when a club had fined him for being drunk and disorderly. He loved fishing. That's another thing that's hard to figure because it's such a quiet, contemplative activity for somebody who was always running off somewhere. But this is my favorite story of missing Rube Waddell. I think this was with the Philadelphia A's, but who knows? It could have been with any of his many teams, and it also could have been mythical. He's supposed to make his start, but he can't be found anywhere, and Connie Mack has his coaches and ballplayers fanned out around Philadelphia looking everywhere for Rube. Is he in a saloon drinking? Where could he be? Where could he be? Mack and his boys are at a total loss, but then they hear this. Hey! There's a parade coming up the street. Well, we better hold off our search for Rube until... Wait a minute. Who's that with the baton at the front of the column? It's Rube! Yes, he was leading a parade. I don't know whether they got him to pitch or not that day, but you have to hand it to him. That's a hell of a stunt. And I don't even know if it was a stunt. He was kind of a cross between Ferris Bueller and Chauncey Gardner. He was just the kind of guy who would wake up one morning and a couple hours later would be leading a parade. He was much more likely, though, to be pulling people out of a burning building. He had a thing about fires, or specifically firemen. I make him sound like an arsonist, but he was the opposite. He lived to put out fires. He worshipped firemen to the extent that he sometimes wore a red union suit under his baseball uniform so he could rip it off like Superman if he heard a siren. And whereas fans or opposing teammates could throw him off his game by distracting him with a cute puppy or a scary snake, nothing got him like fire engines. Connie Mack said this in Baseball Magazine in 1912. We used to put Rube in center field when we weren't pitching him. He never wanted to sit on the bench, and we had to humor him or he wouldn't have stayed on the lot. He was a bully fielder, too. One day we were having quite a battle with some team and Rube was covering center field for us. We were being hard-pressed. With only one out, the other team filled the bases in the fifth inning, and a brace of good batters were up. We had two strikes on the next man, and then something happened. A black cloud of smoke appeared in the sky back of center field fence, and a little later, a blaze. Then came the clash and clanking of fire bells and the clatter of horses' hoofs. I happened to look in the direction of the blaze. High up on the center field fence, I saw Rube perched, looking at the blaze silhouetted against the red glare of the conflagration. I let out a blast that nearly woke the dead. Rube heard me and looked around. He seemed undecided as to his next move, but he wasn't long in making up his mind. With a graceful salute of his hand, as if to say, "So long, fellows," he dropped from sight on the other side of the fence and was on his way to the fire. And he didn't just spectate when he got to the fire. He ran into burning buildings and dragged people out. This is documented. And that's not the only thing. I mean, once he was on the ferry from Camden to Philadelphia when someone played a joke on Rube by shouting, "Woman overboard," he dove in. That's how he was about those things. And it happened on the baseball field, too. Now look, some of this might be a little exaggerated. And just as RetroSheet hasn't yet found a game that Rube Waddell played in center field as proposed in the previous anecdote, newspaper reports at the time don't describe this exactly the way I'm going to tell it to you. But as the song goes, some of this is true, and some of this is better, and this is how I prefer to think about it. On July 1st, 1904, the A's were in Boston playing the Red Sox. The Red Sox starter was a pitcher named Jesse Tannehill. And at bat was an outfielder, a young one, a second-year player named Danny Hoffman, and Rube had taken a liking to him. Well, Tannehill came inside, and Hoffman couldn't get out of the way. He didn't even try, really. People describe what happened to Ray Chapman the same way, as if he was in a trance-like state, hypnotized by the ball and just couldn't move. And the ball smacked him right under the right eye. It was apparently a devastating injury. He went down. Some reports say that the eye was nearly pushed out of the socket by the force of the blow. The A's surrounded the kid. The team doctor came out. And everybody's saying, "Where's the ambulance already? Where is the ambulance?" It was being really slow to get there. And the doctor, nervous, said, "If the ambulance doesn't get here now, he's going to die right here." And Rube, hearing this, picked up Hoffman, threw him over his shoulder, and ran him out of the ballpark and onto the street where he got in a cab. And by cab, I possibly mean the kind that was drawn by horses. This was 1904. He then sat with the kid in the hospital all night in his baseball uniform, sponging his brow until he regained consciousness. Rube spent 6 years with the A's. Connie Mack was able to deal with him for much longer than any other baseball official in his life. But in 1905, on the eve of the World Series, he tore up his pitching arm, scuffling with a teammate over a hat. Some people thought maybe he had been bribed to skip the series, but that doesn't appear to be the case. And although he could still pitch after that, he wasn't peak Chris Sale good anymore. He was just pretty good. And that wasn't enough for Connie to deal with him anymore, so he traded him off. Sold him, actually. He pitched for the Browns for a few years before drifting into the minors, and he wound up with the Minneapolis Millers of the American Association. And the manager there, Joe Cantillon, decided to look out for him. In the winter of 1912, he took Rube home with him to his farm, which was in Hickman, Kentucky. Hickman, then as now, is in the southwest corner of the state. It's right on the Mississippi River. And the Mississippi, as it did in 1927, overran its banks and threatened to inundate the town. Who do you suppose it was who stood in the ice-cold torrent, water up to his nipples, piling sandbags? Yes, Rube Waddell. It was water, not a fire, but he looked at it the same way. Pneumonia set in, and he barely survived it and couldn't really shake it. And at that point, perhaps taking advantage of his weakened body, tuberculosis came on board as well. He struggled to pitch for one more year, but he couldn't do it. He was wasted, and a guy who had been 6'1 and 200 pounds was literally shrinking before everyone's eyes. He was failing. In the winter of 1913, he was found incoherent and feverish, wandering the streets of St. Louis. Cantillon took charge of him, sent him to Texas, where his sister was living. Waddell had been married many times, but more often than not wound up in jail for non-support and subsequently divorced. As he further declined, he ended up in a sanitarium and died April 1st, 1914. Connie Mack had helped pay for his medical care, as he would later, along with John McGraw, help pay for him to receive a proper headstone. And if his death wasn't a direct result of going down in the flood, then the man fulfilling his desire to be a hero was at the very least a proximate cause. I'm sure you remember the 1974 Randy Newman song, Louisiana 1927, that became something of an anthem for flooded New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline.
What always strikes me about the song is not just the swelling chorus or the introduction that is right out of Stephen Foster or Gone with the Wind, but the third verse when the President of the United States appears. In real life, the President didn't even come down. Calvin Coolidge said no, he would not go see the flood, though writers and governors and congressmen begged him to heed their call and offer some succor to the people whose lives had been washed away. Instead, he sent Herbert Hoover. And Herbert Hoover did a pretty good job, all things considered, but he also did it on a shoestring because neither he nor Coolidge believed that the government should help anybody whose lives had been swept away by a natural disaster. Hoover relied on the Red Cross, just like we do now. And look, the help isn't enough because in some ways it never can be enough. Still, why is it that we haven't learned anything and we don't know now what Rube Waddell knew over 100 years ago? Hail to the chief, here's the president.
President Coolidge come down to the railroad train. Little fat man with a notepad in his hand. President say, little fat man, you need a shame. What the river has done to this poor cracker's lane.
See, even if the president wasn't really there, that much is accurate. The politician says, isn't it a shame? And shakes his head and goes, but that's all you get. To get more, you need a hero. You need somebody who has something very, very wrong with them, who's distracted by puppy dogs and fire engines, but also knows right from wrong, and knows what Franklin Roosevelt said long after his death is true, that when your neighbor's house is on fire, you don't haggle over the price of a garden hose. And if he happens to be a left-handed pitcher with lightning in his arm, so much the better. I'll be back with Meg Rowley in just a moment. So this is a very special evening for me, as I was explaining to my next guest. I don't normally have a Sunday evening so loaded. First, I get to have what I anticipate is going to be a great conversation, and then I'm going to pause to take painkillers and muscle relaxants, and then go straight from there into the Game of Thrones season finale. So I don't know if I'm going to survive this evening. I hope I do. I think it's going to be great, though. And on that note, I'm going to welcome in Meg Rowley of Baseball Prospectus. How are you, Meg?
I'm doing better than you, maybe, since I don't have to take painkillers or muscle relaxants, although I am similarly prepared to be wrecked and disappointed by Game of Thrones a little later this evening. So we might end up in somewhat similar places, I suppose.
I was about to say the night is still young. I mean, you may need to take them by the time the night is over. Are you as bugged? And there are so many Game of Thrones podcasts. I don't know if we want to spend an hour on this, but are you as bugged by the accordion-like nature of time in this year's episodes? If you read the books, it takes approximately 1,000 pages for anyone to travel half the length of a football field. In this season, because they're in a hurry to get done and free the actors from contract renewals or something, they just zap back and forth as if they had Star Trek-style transporter beams.
So I guess I should declare this. So I read the first book concurrent with watching the first season of the show, and then really enjoyed the show and didn't want to know what was going to happen. So I have read the first original book, but have not read any of the subsequent ones. So I think that because I entered that story primarily as a TV viewer, I was a little less bothered. And I think there have been a couple of, I don't know, time has been sort of funny on this show, because there have been times when I've been really glad that they've allowed travel to unfold the way it might if you had to walk or ride horses somewhere, because we've gotten some really lovely little bits of character development as a result of that. But there have been some interminable, like, travels on this show. So I don't know. I haven't been really bothered by it until the most recent episode where, I don't know, Ravens and Dragons, man, they are super speedy. Who knew? So I don't know. I haven't been as bothered by it as I think book readers have been.
If you forgive me for one mild book spoiler, and at this great distance, I may be getting this slightly wrong or slightly exaggerated. So if people want to let me know, that's fine. But Martin, in writing the books 5 and 6 were supposed to be one book, and he got kind of swamped and ended up having to split it into 2 books because there was just too much material. And one effect of that is that characters disappear for literally 1,000 pages at a time.
Sure.
Arya will say, like, all right, I'm right out the door and heading for the convenience store or anything, really, or someplace on the other side of the universe or whatever. And then you just never see her again for this huge distance of pages. One thing that the show has already whipped by, so I don't feel like this is going to ruin anything for you,
is that Tyrion sets out to go find Daenerys on the other side of the world. And about 2,000 pages later, he's just getting there. And that is where Martin stopped publishing. So, and that was 6 years ago or 7 years ago. It was a long trip, and it is detailed in real time, complete with stops for gas and snacks and drive-thrus and things like that, like things you wouldn't necessarily need to know. So when the show changes that formula, which, as you said, it's mostly stuck to, where people just kind of amble around on horses and exchange character bits, now suddenly you just have action, action, action. And it's very, I'm not saying it's bad, but it's very off-putting.
It's certainly a dramatic change, but I don't know. I'm willing to forgive the sort of narrative conceits of a TV show are different than they are in a novel. And of all the places to sort of cut a corner, I guess that's probably one of the least offensive places that they could do it. I don't know. I've been more irritated by like Arya's apparent inability to tell when people are lying or telling the truth than I have been with the speed of Raven. So I think that if there are problems to be had with this season, they're bigger, more important character ones.
I agree with that completely, and perhaps we'll leave it there. Although if you do return to the books after this season, I'll be interested to hear what you think, because as somebody who I can tell from their writing has an educated background and a well-read background, there's a lot just on that basis alone, never mind in comparison with the show.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the first one, and but for being sort of intrigued by the show, would have, I think, kept reading. So I am anxious to go back and actually finish reading them, because I enjoyed the first one a great deal. So, and who knows, it might be that by the time the show gets around to rolling out another series, I'll have made a sizable dent in many thousands of pages that lay before me. So I don't think we're going to get another season for at least a year based on what HBO said. So
there are a lot of places to start in this conversation. We've already started, but I have a Seattle question that I've been wondering about for roughly 25 years, because I have been to Seattle a few times, but I have not visited in that long. One of the reasons was that last visit just did not go well on a personal basis. But I got to spend a wonderful day on the U Washington campus. And the thing that I took away from me, and I'm hoping this is still true, is that as pigeons are to Trafalgar Square in London, ducks were to this center of the U Washington campus. And I feel very much like Holden Caulfield, but I'm wondering if you might know if the ducks are still there.
Oh, gosh. Well, I will admit that I cheer for UW in collegiate athletics, because I went to a Division III all-women's college. So, you know, not a lot of Bryn Mawr in the college football finals. I don't know. I mean, I'm not intimately familiar with the campus. I have, of course, walked around there, and it is really beautiful. There seem like a normal number of ducks. There are a lot of water features on the UW campus, so I imagine that they hang out. I wonder if there's like a longstanding war between the groundskeepers at UW and the ducks. That would be a thing I could definitely envision. But I don't know. A normal number of ducks? There are ducks. More ducks than pigeons, thankfully, because who needs pigeons?
Well, I hope that this will stay with you then, and that at some point, if you happen to be passing by and you have some curiosity, you'll investigate, because it was a really cool thing to see. I think it was mallards as far as the eye could see, surrounding this one fountain, or as you said, water feature. It's a little bit hazy, and I was a little bit confused, a little bit teenage, a little bit distracted. That was the saving grace. That was what I took away, was just this colloquium of ducks.
Well, you should come back, because, you know, Seattle has changed really dramatically in the course of my lifetime. And I grew up here and then was away for 10 years about, and moved back 2 years ago. And there are parts of Seattle that are just unrecognizable to me. So I wonder if you would come back and not have any weird pangs of prior bad visit, because it'll be so different than the last time you were here. We are not the same sort of grungy outpost on the edge of the country that we once were. So I think you might have a different experience if you were to come back.
I enjoyed it to the extent that I did get to hang out and see things, and I was in the university area. And the thing that I kind of treasure is that, and maybe it's still like this, there was a, and I know they're out of business now, but in the university area, there was a street, and on one side there was a Tower Records, and on the other side there was a store selling Birkenstocks, which seemed very Seattle to me. And I had gotten kind of momentarily kicked out of where I was staying and found myself kind of spending a day pretending to be homeless. And that sounds terrible, but that was kind of the dramatic space I was in. And I wound up on the corner outside of this Tower Records, and there was a guy busking and singing Beatles songs. And I just stood next to him for a couple of hours and eventually asked if I could sing along with him, and just having no place else to go, just spent time on that corner singing Beatles songs, doing bad harmonies, and letting him collect all the change that people threw in the guitar case.
Wow. Yeah, we are sadly without Tower Records anymore, but we still have a couple of vinyl outposts. Seattle still has its quirks. It's still got a little funk to it, but like many cities that kind of go through a period where wealth sort of rises dramatically, a lot of the rougher edges have been smoothed out, unfortunately, although we still have a fairly dramatic and terrible homelessness crisis here. So that sad fact we have been unable to remedy despite the great wealth that is here. So some parts of it might remain familiar to you, but it's not quite as funky as it once was, but Birkenstocks remain prevalent. I am wearing a pair right now, actually. So some things are the same.
That was almost a test for me with the person that I was involved with there. The first thing was, do you own a pair of Birkenstocks? Do you know what Birkenstocks are? And I didn't. They are not, or at least weren't, they in those sort of primitive internet days had not penetrated this part of the country to any extent. And then when I expressed my ignorance, was told, no, they're the most wonderful thing. They'll change your life. It's almost a religious experience. And I have to admit, I still don't quite get that, but I'm willing to just stipulate that for a certain population of people, that this footwear is the path to wisdom.
They are quite comfortable. They are the best summer sandal, in my humble opinion. But I don't know that I've ever thought of them as a particularly religious experience. I might not be quite as Seattle as I thought.
Or possibly you can see why that relationship didn't work out. Yeah. For me. I don't know. So I want to ask about the Celebrating Women in Baseball night, if you're not bored of talking about it at this point, given that it was almost 2 weeks
never
ago.
Never bored of talking about that event.
That was August 15th, and I watched the live stream. It was you hosting, and you had a great panel. You had Shannon Dreyer, who's the sports writer, and Sarah Gellis, am I saying that right? I think I am. Director of analytics for the Orioles, Amanda Hopkins, who's a scout for the Mariners, Kelly Monroe, who's in baseball information. And I feel like the value of the panel was almost just in the fact of it, that there was a representation there, that you had gathered all of these people who the average baseball fan or average, not just woman, but everybody might not have been aware that there was this diversity in baseball. And the stories were enjoyable. Everybody talking about their experience was great, and the Q&A was great. But I think I was more struck by the fact that they were all just there in one place, and you had this power of representation happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to that. It's so unusual when you're a female fan to be able to attend events centered around baseball and see people who look anything like you. You know, I have that experience as a baseball writer, where I will go to events where, you know, we'll organize opportunities for sort of writers to get to talk to their readers, and they're always a lot of fun. But I'm always struck by, like, people know my name, and I don't mean that in like a self-aggrandizing way. It's just that by, you know, process of elimination, there are so few of us who do this, although certainly more than I think people realize. And so people will walk up to me at those events and be like, "You're Meg." And I'm like, "You're a white guy. It's so nice to meet you, white guy." And so I think that when I was sitting up there as the moderator and I was looking out at the crowd, it's like the crowd was predominantly women. I mean, there was a great diversity there. And I think that, like you said, this was just such a it's such a rare opportunity to get to hear from people in those roles that there was a lot of appeal for every kind of fan, not just for women, but to look out at a crowd that was predominantly women and then to have a panel that was entirely made of women and to have them sort of really honestly grapple with some of the struggles that they've had and some of the challenges that they have faced and that we still face in sort of bringing about a more diverse front office and press box, you know, I think about how much that would mean to me as a fan. It meant a lot to me as a moderator and a writer, but to, you know, be a young woman and get to go to an event like that, like you said, I think a lot of the power was just in the representation because it's so unusual for us to be able to assemble a group like that and have it be endorsed and supported by a team, and to have it sort of strike the right notes where it's about the experience of baseball and not about, you know, a drink ticket, and it's not about teaching you what an RBI is or anything like that, but to just sort of assume a level of competence in your audience and to have the panel sort of speak to that level, I think is really powerful. And it was kind of overwhelming for me, honestly, after the fact to see that we had done that, because it was so novel. And I hope that, you know, this time next year, we're talking about many events like this. But I think for the first one to bring together such an incredible lineup was really amazing.
It was shocking to me in a way. It was such a smart and intelligent thing to do. I was surprised that no one had really done anything like this before.
Yeah, I'm always surprised by how, you know, I like to sort of make a strained comparison to sort of the early days of sabermetrics. It's like, these seem like obvious wins, right? Like, these seem like obvious changes. This is the, like, not bunting of ballpark promotions, right? Like, this is an easy win. And I think that one of the things that I was really encouraged by was that it did so well, not only the reception online, although, you know, you can kind of get in this little Twitter echo chamber where people agree with you, but I think they sold like 220 tickets to that event. Like, they were able to make not only a case of wanting to be an organization that sort of acknowledged its entire fan base, but there's a commercial case there too, right? Like, there is demand for this kind of event. And I think that it is sort of amazing that nobody has thought before, like, huh, I bet women really love baseball and know what it's about. Maybe we should design an event with that in mind that isn't about, you know, the word ladies and the color pink, which, you know, there's a place for those events and there are definitely fans who enjoy them and relate to the game that way. But I think I was surprised that we were the first sort of event to not take such a narrow view of what the female baseball audience might enjoy.
That's one aspect of this that I've kind of struggled with. And in thinking about this conversation, I tried to investigate my own feelings about that aspect, the pink aspect, the ladies aspect of things, because like you, I've always been down on those events because they seem very patronizing in a way.
Yeah.
Come to the ballpark and we'll merchandise to you is what it mostly seems like, right? We're going to sell you different women's products, makeup or perfume or team gear that's in pink or whatever. And there have been some that have even been worse than that. And just assume that there's no interest in baseball as a game. It's baseball as a social thing or baseball as an appendage to some male. I've always wondered, you know, who would go to that? And clearly people do because they keep having these events. So there must be some appeal to them. I thought back, though, to a girl that I was friends with when I was in high school. And she was a Mets fan. And she was a real baseball fan. But on her bedroom wall, and this is really gross to remember given who the person is I'm about to mention and how he kind of developed over time. But she had a Lenny Dykstra poster on her wall.
Uh-huh.
Lenny was shirtless and he was holding a bat over his shoulder. His muscles were gleaming and he was wearing blue jeans and the blue jeans were unbuttoned about down to his pubes.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it. And I'm not just saying ew out of a sense of heterosexual male anything, but just, ew, it's Lenny Dykstra. And Lenny Dykstra was unappealing then. Even when he was like a really productive MVP baseball level player, he was this guy with a giant wad of chew in his mouth. And I think it was Andy Van Slyke who said that if you played in the outfield where Lenny Dykstra had been standing, you could get cancer just from the tobacco juice on the turf.
Jeez.
But is that a legitimate way of interacting with the game too? I mean, it's, I feel like she was a real fan And I feel like she had, was conversant in the nature of the game, the way that you and I are. And then she also had obviously this fan relationship with Lenny Dykstra that was about her perception of his masculine appeal. And I feel like that's a real thing too. And I'm having trouble formulating this question because I just don't want to invalidate anybody. And yeah. I don't know where you draw the line. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think so. I've thought a lot about this too, because my, like, for the record, like, I own a pair of socks that has Kyle Seager on them. So like, we all engage in fandom in sort of weird ways. Fandom is inherently a very strange exercise. So I think that where I've kind of, the idea I've come around to after thinking about this a lot is that there are a lot of different ways to be a fan and engage in fandom. You know, I've gotten manicures in Seahawks colors, right? Like there are a lot of different ways to do it. And I think that where baseball as an institution gets into trouble is when it looks at groups that maybe historically have not been perceived as legitimate fans and tries to hem in the ways in which they can engage with the team around their fandom. So I wouldn't buy a pink jersey. Like, that's not appealing to me. But there are women who love baseball and like their teams and want that. You know, that's the way that they want to express their fandom. And I think that there's nothing wrong with any one individual sort of figuring out where the bounds and contours of that fandom are, as long as the team and the institution of baseball in the league is saying your engagement with the sport is valid and it is real on baseball terms. And the, you know, the color and the, you know, manifestation of that can be a lot of different things, but we are going to assume that you care about this sport and are a valid member of this sort of weird fan community that we have assembled. And I think as long as that's true and teams strive to give their fans, you know, regardless of who they are or what their demographics are, a lot of different ways to engage the team, I think that's fine. If you want to wear a pink jersey to the ballpark and that's how you understand your fandom, okay, great. Like, that's fine. I think where we get in trouble is when we start to either define that as the only way to be a fan, or we look at it and say that the primary way that women are fans is through means that don't have anything to really do with the game itself. And I think that's what comes across as so patronizing and condescending about a lot of the prior events that teams have done. Like, I don't need you to, and by the way, they always do it in like the lowest level. They're like, here's what an RBI is. And I'm like, I don't need you to define this term. And I would appreciate if you're doing game education that you talk about why that's garbage, right? Like at least pitch it to a slightly more advanced level if you're going to do it. But we don't have to, we should just assume that people know stuff. Just assume people know stuff, because we never ask men if they know stuff. We just don't. We assume that men know stuff about baseball. And I bet there's a real range of knowledge for all fans. And so I think that if we just, you know, assume that people know things and that their interest is sincere, you do a lot of the work that you need to do to be a more inclusive environment and really see your fans as they see themselves. So, but maybe stay away from Lenny Dykstra. Might draw a line there. I might be comfortable drawing the line at Lenny Dykstra, but otherwise I think you can kind of do a bunch of different stuff.
Will we invoke more inappropriately attired athletes from the 1980s? Come back after these messages and find out.
That's a great answer. And I was thinking that there's also the reverse of not just talking down to a certain aspect of the fan base or not just patronizing them, but also objectifying them. And even if you're not in that particular moment talking to them, you're talking only to the male segment.
Right.
By just osmosis, you are delivering a message. And Back in June, the Ogden Raptors, who are a Dodgers franchise in the Pioneer League, they momentarily released this promotion. They ended up not doing it because there was a massive backlash, and they claimed that, like, oh, we were never serious about this. This was an accident. The idea was Hourglass Appreciation Night.
Right.
The idea was that they were going to have these models come in and do color. They literally were going to be the color. Whether you think that's a right thing or a wrong thing, or there's a place for that in the ballpark, it really is sending a message to one half of the population, or a large percentage of the fan base, that this is not about you. This is not where you should be. We are catering explicitly in this moment to male prurients.
Right. Yeah. I remember that promotion, and I hope I'm not misremembering or speaking out of turn here, but I think that when it happened, I went and looked at their front office page. And if I recall correctly, they didn't have any women working in promotions, in marketing, or in roles that would have had something to say about that particular promotion. So part of this is just, you know, one of the arguments for a diverse front office is that you have hopefully someone in the room to be like, guys, do we think this is a good idea? Are we making good choices? But I think you're right. Like, we fret so much about the health of baseball, and we fret so much about how it's finding its audience in a younger generation, and how we're passing on sort of a passion for the game to people who are not 55. And so I think that if for no other reason than you can't afford to alienate half of your fan base, it's probably a good idea to not do stuff like that, even in the interest of sort of appealing to a segment of the fan base that might find that enthralling or whatever. It's just, you know, we probably don't want to set that as a perspective that we are elevating to the point of the team endorsing it, even if it does exist for members of the fan base. It's like, I'm also a football fan in addition to being a baseball fan, although I'm happy to be much more ignorant of football than I am of baseball. I will go to games and the cheerleaders come out and I'm like, oh, so this is the part that isn't for me. I am not the target audience for this. And that's fine, I guess, except that, like, I don't pay less for my ticket for the part that isn't about me as, you know, my dad or my brother-in-law does. And, you know, we as a family really enjoy the uncomfortable experience of sitting there watching cheerleaders. It seems like it's so easy to avoid those mistakes, but we keep making them. And I wonder if the answer is just make sure you hire more diverse groups of people so that somebody there can be the voice of reason asking the question of whether you're really engaging the entirety of your fan base or if you're just appealing to some of the baser elements.
And what you're saying is really important. And this was another thing that I thought about a lot in coming into this conversation. We're talking about an event that was Women in Baseball Night, and we're talking about marketing the game not just to men, but to all fans, and being inclusive of all fans. And we shouldn't pretend that objectification doesn't exist, or that there's not a healthy version of people admiring other people's bodies. All those things are real and are part of the human condition. But again, what we're talking about is being a game for all the people all the time and not erring too far in one direction or the other, although it's hard to imagine a team going too far in the opposite direction. The reason that I want to emphasize that is that if we start talking about this or talk about it in terms of female or feminist or any of these charged, it's funny to say female is a charged term, but this is a strange time in our nation's life. Any of these charged terms that sound like advocacy that allow people to have this knee-jerk reaction and tune out, it's not about that. It's not about special pleading. And there are a lot of legitimate reasons for making those arguments, but this is about being a game for all the people and not cutting off one segment of the fan base in just ignorance of that segment existing.
Yeah, I mean, fans they invest so much. You know, they invest time, they invest money, they invest their emotional resources, they invest all of this stuff into the teams that they root for. And it feels really terrible when this thing that you love makes clear that it doesn't love you back. And that's, you know, we could all maybe stand to be a little less emotionally invested in sports because there are a lot of more important things in the world that we could devote our time and resources to. But we make these communities around these events and we understand part of our place in the communities we inhabit away from the ballpark in terms of those teams. And so I think that if for no other reason than that goodwill means a lot and goes really far to helping people justify their various forms of investment in their teams, I think the case is really clear for trying to just keep in mind how it reads to large segments of your community and your fan base when you prioritize sort of the prurient interests of one small segment over the general enjoyment that, you know, half of your potential fan base might have. And I think you're right. Like, I don't say it to be a buzzkill or anything. And like you said, like, there, you know, I will look at a baseball player who is handsome and say, my, that is a handsome baseball player. And so there is a certain amount of this that is like a natural, normal reaction, especially for people who are just, you know, incredible athletes. They're in amazing shape. But that's very different than a team sort of taking that experience and sort of centering their messaging around it. And I think for women in particular, we are so often told that this is supposed to be a space that we are sort of begrudgingly admitted to. And so it really does mean a lot when a team says, no, there's room for you here. And not only is there room for you, but we're going to celebrate and acknowledge and appreciate your commitment and interest in this thing rather than just finally having jerseys that are in women's cut, you know? So I think it doesn't cost very much to build that goodwill. And it's also really easy to tear it down. And so I hope that teams just consider those things and sort of balance them out in the right way, because it means a lot. There are times when I feel, you know, I still consider myself a fan of the Mariners, and there are times when that fandom is sort of more intense than others. But as a fan, it really meant a lot to walk into a meeting with the team that I grew up rooting for, that I've literally like rooted for my entire life, and have them hear and understand what we were trying to do to make this event different from other women's events. And as a fan, that meant a lot. They haven't always given their fans a lot to cheer for, and we can talk about that too. But this means way more, honestly, than a wild card appearance, to me at least. Because I spend a lot of time on this thing, and it's nice to have that thing see me.
Let me ask about the reverse of that, too, because we've seen pushback on Jessica Mendoza calling Sunday night games. Jessica Luther, there are a lot of Jessicas in our story today. Mm-hmm. Jessica Luther published a story, this incredibly heartwarming story about this girl's travel team, hardball travel team. I didn't see all the pushback on social media because I think, fortunately, a lot of embarrassed people deleted a lot of stuff before I got to see it. But that was supposedly on the legendarily awful level. And I've even seen some of the comments you've gotten on stories where you have taken on baseball and domestic violence, and you took it on in the most careful, fan-centered way possible that was not accusatory, not condemnatory, not sticking out any kind of aggressive space. And yet a lot of people didn't get it. And so I'm wondering if you got any pushback on this event.
You know, not really. I mean, we got a little bit. There was like a little bit. And it could be that the official Twitter account for the Mariners maybe saw some of it that I didn't. I know that there was a little tiny bit of nastiness on Facebook, but overwhelmingly the response was a very positive one. And I think that's one of the places where you see the team buying in really matter, because the folks that have I'm going to generalize pretty dramatically here, but in my experience of the kinds of men who object to those events or object to my writing on domestic violence or who were going after little girls trying to play baseball for a travel team. Like, I hope that they thought about that at the end of the day. Like, I spent my day trying to make children feel bad. Anyway, they're just looking for an opening, and they sort of sense weakness and sense when support might be sort of equivocal. So I think that the team having a really strong stance, like, this is what we're doing, this is what we're about, helped a lot. But no, there wasn't a ton that was negative. I mean, it's hard to push back on this. Like, these are women who work in baseball, here to tell you about baseball. I was encouraged that many of the nasty responses were, like, thoroughly unimaginative and sort of knee-jerk. It's like, get back to the kitchen. I'm like, oh, sorry, buddy. I guess ship has sailed. They're in the front office. Whoops. He didn't get that one. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nastiness out there, but I think that there are a lot of people who are willing to sort of back up female writers, female reporters, when that stuff is directed their way. And, you know, I've been fortunate. This is such a weird thing to feel fortunate about, but I've been fortunate in that my own experience, that stuff hasn't gotten quite as nasty or as scary as it has for some women, but that does exist out there. And it is a thing that we, like, have to reckon with. You know, I think about it every time I write about baseball. I think about what thing in this is going to inspire some dude to try to come at me with whatever nonsense he has. Like, people were mad that I was sad that Pitch was canceled. They were grumpy because I liked a TV show. So there is some segment of the baseball fan base that is just going to be unpleasant about that stuff. And I don't know that there's much you can do about it other than keep doing the events so that they see that perspective will not be allowed to be the dominant one.
I thought that was a great piece, by the way, and not just because it was about this TV show or that you had written it well, because you always write well, but because you put into words something that I've thought for a long time about women in baseball and the possibility of women's players. And even though you didn't mention this person, Jackie Robinson, too, in that I've always thought that Jackie Robinson breaking the color line was about the greatest moment in American history in some ways. And I mean, that sounds hyperbolic given everything else we've been through, but this huge, horrible, evil taboo was shattered. And it was shattered in a way that you couldn't argue with it, because the guy could play and he showed he could play and there was no disputing that. The only dispute that you had was you just didn't like him for some amorphously terrible thing that you'd been taught down through the generations. And the power of that, and you use this word, and I freely admit I borrowed it from you when I brought it up earlier in this conversation because you put it in my head. The representation, the fact that you had this example there, I think you really can, without exaggerating, say, that's a high point on the road from there to Martin Luther King, to the Civil Rights Act, and so on. And so when you talked about that show, not just in terms of it being a show, because look, as a show, it was imperfect.
Sure.
But as a fantasy of what that moment would be like for the female gender, that seemed to me to be inseparable from what Jackie Robinson did. Not exactly the same way, not quite the same thing, but that same kind of spirit that you could see somebody who could do it. And to me, that baseball is a meritocracy, that it's aspirational. To me, that's what the game is about. I don't understand why somebody wouldn't like that piece, because I think you were pointing out something that is very, very basic to the spirit of the game.
I want to be careful here, because there are definitely institutional forces within the game that limit or make harder the participation of some people. So I don't want to discount those. But I think that when you look at a baseball field, the democracy of bodies that you see is a really powerful force within the game. I mean, so last season, the Mariners had Dae-ho Lee on the team from Korea, and there was a cheering section for him every game. Part of the Mariners fan base in the Korean community in Seattle came out every game to watch him. And it was clear that his presence there, I mean, these were baseball fans. These were people who I think were Mariners fans before Dae-ho's signing, but they were seeing something on the field that was different than what they had gotten to experience with the team in other seasons. And so that matters to people because it gives you something to aspire to dream on. You know, it lets you tell your children with greater credibility, people like us can do this thing. I have a 1-year-old niece, and my sister's not a huge baseball fan, but my brother-in-law played baseball all through high school. I don't know if my niece will want to play baseball. I mean, she's one. Who knows what she'll want to do? I think about, I mean, I don't want to be like overly self-important in my writing, but I think about the work that I do And I want her to be able to like look up at the world and be like, I can do whatever I want. And to have that have some credibility behind it. And so even though it was a fictional portrayal, even though, you know, I think the first female major leaguer is probably a ways off, that part of the dialogue around the sport would involve a woman at the center of a baseball story really mattered a lot. Because you looked at her and the actress was so wonderful and the portrayal was so sincere and serious without being self-serious. I think the show, for all its faults, balanced that really well. It allowed you to think, well, sure, that could be possible. There could be a woman who could do this. I mean, you look at major leaguers, and I think part of the reason that we're, as a commentariat, sort of coming around to the idea of it being really important that little girls be able to play little league. Like, look at Mike Trout. I don't like to use the word athletic freak. Like, I don't like that phrase because I think it does weird stuff and can mean a lot of weird things. But, like, Mike Trout is a freak. Like, that a person can do what he can do is unreal. And I'm not saying that, like, the first female major leaguer will be Mike Trout, like, in terms of her production on the field or what she'll contribute to the sport. But you're much more likely to find the Mike Trouts if a lot of little boys can play baseball, because most little boys don't grow up to be Mike Trout. Most major leaguers don't grow up to be Mike Trout. And so I think that the representational part of it is really important, because if you think, I should be able to do this, there's no reason I can't, then you get a lot of little girls who want to go play baseball. And then maybe we find among all those little girls, they're Mike Trout. And we won't know the answer to that in any kind of a definitive way until you have more equitable access to the game. And so I think if for no other reason than it inspires people to demand that they have access to something that they are being excluded from for no good reason, that representation is important. Because who knows, like maybe my niece will pick up a baseball one day and be like, I could throw a great knuckleball. I have a great pitch. And I could be the first female reliever. I could be the first female starter. Who knows? Daeho Lee plays baseball. And Ichiro plays baseball. And Aaron Judge plays baseball. I don't think that we can say with any credibility what the bounds of the body are for playing baseball. Because all of those men play baseball and all of them have done it well enough to be major leaguers. Some well enough to be Hall of Famers. Let's find out. And I think that's the part that threatens some men the most, honestly. Because it's like, if the answer to that is yes, then they have to reckon with something that they've maybe closed off as a possibility for a really long time.
Well, the people who are really threatened would be the same people or the same class of baseball player who were threatened by the influx of African Americans into the game,
right.
Namely the people who were marginal major leaguers in the first place, who were only there because they were protected from real competition for their jobs. If you have another source of baseball talent, each additional source of talent that you have strains the lower level. The Mike Trouts are going to be safe, right, No matter what. It's the utility infielders and those guys who are going to have to defend their jobs. That's not even what you were talking about. You were talking on a more existential, just basic philosophical level of women can't do this. This is exclusively a male thing.
Yeah. And that was the funny part of the response to that piece I wrote about pitch, because a lot of the people who were sort of grumpy in my mentions were like, well, this doesn't mean anything. I'm like, I'm literally a woman telling you it meant something. Yeah, it did. It mattered to me. And it mattered to a lot of people. Did it matter to enough people for Fox to keep the show? Maybe not. But it did matter. I'm telling you that. It mattered to me. I'm always struck by the sort of resistance to that, because I'm like, what does it cost you to just find out?
You're absolutely right. I mean, if baseball wants it to happen, it will happen. I have had scouty type people say, no, it's just impossible. But I don't believe that, just because being aware, and you just said this better than I'll say it, but given the historic breadth of physical types who have played the game and play it even now, from guys who are barely 5 feet tall to guys like Aaron Judge, who are about 8 feet tall, somewhere in there, there's room. The problem is that as long as it's one Julie Croteau, if you remember her playing first base at the college level, or it's one Silver Bullets team that because of the affiliation with alcohol weren't allowed to be true young players, or it's isolated anything, you're not going to have the great sorting device that baseball has now with high school, college, the minor leagues, and so on. You need to have that infrastructure in place.
Right.
And then I'm reasonably sure that if they put the time and money in, somebody would emerge. It's just they have to make a commitment to it.
Yeah. And I do worry about how well incentivized they will be to make that investment, because I think you're right that, I mean, part of the reason that young women play softball is because after a while they can't play baseball. Part of the reason they do it is because a lot of young women go to college on softball scholarships. And so there is some infrastructure that needs to be built around that so that it's a reasonable and real path for someone. But I think we won't know what that number is until that investment is made. But I do hope that it's more than one, because it does seem like a just unreal, terrific amount of pressure to put on one person.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, prospects fail all the time. So I hope that whoever that woman is, she's able to come up with some friends so that, and some, you know, teammates, so that it is not the responsibility of one person to be sort of proof of concept on women in the majors, because that's going to take a really impressive person to navigate and manage.
And now we're back to the Jackie Robinson story, because that's who he was on every level, and he suffered for it, and he died young. And even though he had all kinds of health problems, I think that dying young was part of that. But let's put this challenge out, Meg, because as you were saying that, I was thinking, hey, Theo Epstein, you took the Red Sox, an organization that was destroyed for 100 years by racism, and you fixed them. And then you went to the Cubs and you ended a 100-year slide there that was partially racism and partially just aggregated incompetence over years and years and years. You want to go to the Hall of Fame, though, as the next Branch Rickey, as in fact a guy who did better than Branch Rickey? Here's your challenge. Start investing in women in baseball.
Yeah, and I'm glad to see that the league is sort of taking it seriously, although I think that they keep putting a butt after all their commitments, because they're like, and also we're really excited about softball. And I'm like, well, that's great. And softball is a great sport, but it's not baseball. It's a different sport. So, you know, like, maybe have your internal conversation about what you're trying to do. But yeah, it's going to take someone saying, I want there to be a woman in the majors in 15 years. And that's going to take a lot of commitment and money and sort of a strong constitution to deal with the inevitable backlash to that. But I think that you would see sort of a fan response to that that might be not unprecedented, but unprecedented in the modern era of baseball. I'll buy that jersey. I don't care what team she's on.
Me too.
So if we're serious about it, it's something that is achievable in our lifetime, but we're going to need baseball to get serious about it, because, you know, it's not something that little girls can achieve on their own.
You know, Meg, I feel sort of bad because we've eaten almost all of our time together, and I don't want to pigeonhole you into just this one area, because obviously you write about a lot of other things and you are so much bigger than this one topic, and yet it's such a large topic that we could talk about it endlessly. I do want to get to some of that other stuff. I do want to ask you one more question about this topic. But before we do, I just wanted to note that I feel like I had a missed opportunity somewhere, because we were both at SB Nation at the same time, and I didn't realize it. And then here's another link, which is the guy who helped bring me to SB Nation and has been very important in my career and a very good friend, was Rob Nyer. And when he left, he apparently took you with him.
Well, he certainly brought me on to freelance at Just a Bit Outside. Yeah, it was September of 2015, I guess. I had written a very silly post about bobbleheads, because I'm a bobblehead collector. And I don't know how Rob found it or saw it, but he did. And I don't know why he thought that meant I had something more to say about baseball, but he did. And so he sort of invited me to do some freelance work at Jabo. And so I had a very fun couple of months, and then sadly, Jabo folded. There was no more Jabo.
Surely a coincidence.
Yeah, no, it's all my fault. I'm so sorry, Rob. But yeah, that was sort of my first my first exposure away from Lookout, really. And then that fall is when I came on at BP. So yeah, I did, I guess, a year and a half, 2 years at Lookout before I work a full-time job in addition to writing, which is sadly not my full-time job. So I only had so many writing hours in the day, and they're such a great site and have high editorial standards, which is lovely for a team site, and I just couldn't do them justice anymore. So that's sort of when my time at Lookout ended. But yeah, I didn't realize that we overlapped. That's too bad. We should have We should have been friends earlier.
We should have been. And it's such a high compliment when Rob picks you, because I don't know if you've had this experience with Rob, but he is very exacting and very persnickety about who gets to appear on his website. And I've had the experience of bringing writers to Rob for different things and saying, use this person. And Rob has said, not good enough.
Huh.
And so that A, I have at times been good enough, I have always taken as a very high compliment. And that he thought you were good enough, I take it the same way, as a very high compliment.
Yeah, there are a couple of people who I would point to as having sort of dramatically improved the quality of my writing. Some of those people were in, you know, a former life when I was trying to be a political theorist, and they gave me sort of the academic runaround on endless edits and endless drafts. But, you know, I think about the people who have edited me as a baseball writer, and there are three who really, I think, helped to change my work for the better and help me think about how I wanted to present ideas, and Rob is definitely in that group. I sometimes was really discouraged to get drafts back from him because you're right, he is quite exacting, but, you know, always really improved my work for the better. So I'm grateful he gave me the chance, and I'm grateful that, you know, sometimes when drafts weren't quite what they needed to be to go live, that he had the patience to help them get better. So
he's an incredibly kind person. He's sometimes very blunt about expressing criticisms, but hidden behind that is a person who is very, very kind, and he's done that for a lot of people. So
yeah,
it's just not something that he chooses to publicize. So for all I know, I'm going to get an angry email after this, but it's worth talking about. Before we do wrap up, since you are a Mariners fan and do write a lot, or at least think a lot about the Mariners and tweet a lot about the Mariners, I did want to ask, vis-a-vis this event, and you brought this up yourself, do you find now that it's difficult to be objective about the Mariners when you write about them? For a lot of us, I think that the fan stuff wears away once it becomes more of a profession. You get some distance on that. But it seems like because they were very supportive of you, it would be very natural to cleave even more strongly to them.
I think the way that I would describe it, I mean, I've definitely noticed my, I don't want to say that it's waned, but it's less, I guess it has, it's less emotionally resonant in any given moment of baseball than it was before. One of the things about being a Mariners fan is that it's easy to be objective about the Mariners because they were so bad for so long. This is a very different team for all their faults and flaws. This is a very different Mariners team. I had this conversation with another writer friend. I'll see people who are mad on Twitter about how the Mariners have been sort of around 500 for the last couple of years. And I'm like, God, do you remember 2010? I would have killed for a 500 team. Good grief. We watched just unwatchable baseball at times. I mean, it was so bad. So I think that when you're rooting for a team that has been sort of hard luck for as long as the Mariners have, and if, you know, I was in high school the last time I got to watch a postseason game with the Mariners. You know, we've had like three presidents and we've gone to war a couple times. It's been a minute. And so I think, you know, unlike rooting for, you know, the Yankees or the Giants or the Cardinals, you know, there's been a lot of bad baseball. And so it's easier to be objective about them when that's the case. I'd like to think that I do an okay job of separating the sort of emotional fan response or even the informed sort of sabermetric fan response from the analyst in me. I'm sure I don't do that perfectly because no one does, but I don't know. Like when they're bad, they're pretty obviously bad. When they're good, sometimes they're lucky. And sometimes they're objectively good. And I think that because they have all of those shades sort of in their clubhouse, there's a lot to say about the good and the bad and the ugly. And so I wouldn't come on and say that a team that committed five errors in one inning today played particularly good baseball. That wasn't a great game.
And yet they still have a shot at the postseason.
They do. God bless the terrible American League. My goodness. Or the very evenly matched American League, depending on what your mood is on any given day. I prefer when they win. I don't like when they lose. But I am also at the point in my experience of baseball where, like, it took me a long time to be able to really genuinely enjoy Mike Trout. It took a minute, which is silly. Right. It's crazy because he's maybe I mean, he's certainly the best baseball player I've ever watched and might be one of the best, if not the best ever. And I hated him. I was like, ah, that Mike Trout. He's miserable. His smug face. And it's like, no, he's amazing. What is wrong with you? Like, enjoy Mike Trout. If you can't enjoy Mike Trout, what are you doing? You should do something else. So it took me a minute, but I'm there now. So I prefer that the Mariners win to lose, and I also will happily watch players playing against them and be happy that they are doing well individually. I mean, you go in and out, you have moments. Like at the end of the season last year, they were so close, and so I had a couple of days and games where I just made a point of not being on Twitter because I was like, I'm going to respond to this as a fan, and that might be professionally limiting. So I'm going to keep those thoughts to myself. And you know, when the postseason starts, I'll be more objective. But I don't know, you just do the best you can to strike balance and hope that people will be forgiving when you react as a human and not as a writer or an analyst.
You know what would bug me is not just some of the bad luck that they've had. They're going to play the Orioles this mm-hmm. week, and Chris Tillman is going to pitch against them. I'm sure you remember this, but in February 2008, the then general manager Bill Bavassi dealt Tillman and Adam yep. Jones and like three other guys yep. to the Orioles for Eric Bedard. And it is more than 9 years later, and they are still there. That has to be one of the worst trades of all time.
Yeah.
And one that continues to haunt the franchise. And I'm not saying that they haven't had a chance to turn things over many times since then. And Jerry DePoto may have turned things over that many times in the last 2 weeks. It's those kinds of things that I would have a really hard time letting go of as a fan until they actually won something.
Yeah. Although I wonder how quickly the narrative will change. You know, I think if the Mariners have a home playoff game, we talk about the team really differently after that. How many people are still talking about how long the Blue Jays drought was? Well, they're not, because they've been back. Like, it's over. You know, they're a team that has recently been in the playoffs, and it won't take a whole lot, at least for the narrative to change. But like I said, like, you know, we've had three presidents. We've gone to war. Like, I have a computer in my pocket on my phone now. It's a really different world than it was. And, you know, I was in high school. Like, I know so much more now than I did the last time. It's time. I've seen Mariners fans on Twitter be really keen to sort of start the rebuild. I appreciate and understand that impulse. And I get the arguments about why this team is sort of the horizon is somewhat limited for them in the next couple of years. But I'm surprised by the enthusiasm that some fans seem to have for that, because while there are plenty of baseball reasons why that makes sense, like, this is going to be a long rebuild. You know, the next Mariners core is probably a ways away, and there's going to be a lot of really bad baseball in the meantime after they sort of start this thing in earnest and really decide to tear down and try to build the next great team. So I don't know. I think that we've been weirdly spoiled by a couple of competent years in a row and have maybe forgotten what 2010 felt like. So I don't know, guys, like, enjoy it while you can, because we're going to get some unwatchable baseball in a minute. It'll be here quicker than you necessarily want it to be.
It must be a bittersweet thing in terms of King Felix, in that it would be neat if they did emerge from this wild card scrum to make it. By definition, any team that does is going to be kind of the scrappy underdog.
Yeah.
But he's had such a great career without really having that postseason experience. And I compare, if they were to make it, kind of like it felt for me. And when I was a fan, I was a Yankees fan and was very much a Don Mattingly fan. And when they finally made it to the postseason during his career in 1995 against, ironically, the Mariners,
yeah,
he was such a debilitated version of himself. And he acquitted himself well, as I recall. But it wasn't the Don Mattingly who was the MVP gold glove guy, who was a 350, 30 home run guy. He was so far from that. So I felt this pang for the Don Mattingly that didn't get to do that. And in the same way that if King Felix were to pitch in the postseason now, he's not the guy with the couple of ERA titles and the 200 strikeouts. He's a guy that's held together by thread, it seems.
Yeah.
He's had all the mileage on him of a veteran pitcher. I mean, he is a veteran pitcher, but of a guy who's much older, essentially, because he started so young. I wonder what that will feel like if he goes into the postseason. You have to watch him, and he's not that guy.
I've thought a lot about this because there, you know, there was a moment last year where it looked like they could do it. You know, they were competitive until basically the last day. You know, Felix had not been good and James Paxton had been amazing. And I sat one evening and thought for a long time about what do you do? Like, imagine it lines up so that you can have either guy pitch a wild card. The answer is that you have Paxton do it because you could win a game with Paxton starting and you're a lot less likely to with Felix. And I just thought, what would it feel like if they lose that game and Felix doesn't get his start and might never get one again, you know? And I just don't know if people – there are a lot of fan bases that have had sort of hard luck, and there are a lot of fan bases that have had long droughts. So I don't mean to say that it is an experience that is unique to Mariners fans, but I was living in New York when Felix signed his extension with the Mariners, and, you know, it included a full – and still does, obviously, include a full no-trade clause. And I was living in New York, and I had all these Yankee fan coworkers who were like, I can't believe he'd want to stay there. And I can't believe the Yankees deserve Felix, and baseball deserves Felix on the Yankees. And I was like, I can't get in fights at work, so I just have to sit here and like listen to you say these things. But to have this guy decide to stay, and not just decide to stay with an extension, but to say, I am a Mariner, and if you want to trade me, I'm going to have to say yes. At a time when he was the most valuable asset that the Mariners had. I think more than probably any athlete I've ever watched as a fan, including every member of the sort of late 90s, early 2000s Mariners, I have more affection for him than probably any other baseball player I've ever watched, because at a time when we had nothing, he stayed. And so I dread him starting in the postseason because you're right. I mean, 2014 isn't that long ago when he was legitimate Cy Young candidate. I still maintain that he should have won over Corey Kluber, but that's not that long ago. And he's a different guy now. I think what you would hope for as a fan is that he has one really good start in him so that, you know, when the Hall of Fame conversation starts after he retires, we can point to one game in the postseason and say he wasn't the same guy, but he pulled out a 12 strikeout effort and took them where they needed to go. And not having confidence that he has that in him is heartbreaking.
That would be an awesome story. I have so many other baseball questions to ask, but I can't resist one more writerly question because, like I said, reading you, I can pick up the references that you like to drop sometimes, and I can almost see your reading list. We've already talked about Rob, but who influenced you as a writer? And I'm not talking about now the kind of stuff that we've mostly spent this show discussing, but the kinds of humorous, absurdist kind of takes that you like to have on various personalities in the game.
Well, I would maybe put it to two people, one of whom I still have the pleasure of writing with at BP, which is Patrick Dubuque, who I came to know at Lookout Landing and has edited me at various places now. In addition to just being a really incredible editor, so helping to clarify what I'm trying to do, regardless of how silly or serious it might be. You know, I think he looks at baseball in sort of a similar way and is keen to unpack the little moments that the game offers and see what's inside them. And he's been a really great help to me as a writer since I started doing this in a place that people read that wasn't just my little tiny sports blog I was doing to have something else to write about apart from Foucault and Hobbes and other grad school stuff. And then, you know, I was hired at BP by Sam, and he was and is a, you know, terrific talent and voice of his own and was a great editor. But I mostly remember reading him when he was sort of starting at BP. And, you know, he certainly wasn't the only person who I would put in this camp. But I remember reading something he wrote. I'm not going to get the year right, but he was watching Faces, as he is wont to do, behind home plate at a Diamondbacks game, I think it was. And I remember reading that and being like, oh, I mean, Sam is Sam. So I don't mean to put myself on the same sort of level as Sam in terms of the quality of the writing. But I was like, oh, there are other people who kind of think about baseball this way. So maybe I could think about baseball this way and write about it. And somebody would like let me do that in public. So I think those have been sort of the recent influences. I mean, we all have our sort of folks that will run out, like Rob and Bill James and that crew, because I still think Bill James is sort of underappreciated as a writer.
I agree with that.
I been going back and rereading some of the historical abstracts. I'm like, God, I'm like laughing legitimately at some of the stuff. I forgot how spot on he can be. So, you know, and then like that, y'all on that initial BP crew, I wonder if you realize how influential you have been on a generation of baseball writers who were not so different in age, I don't think, but, you know, who certainly came later in terms of when we got going. So those have been sort of the baseball ones. I mean, I was fortunate to have a number of really great professors who were political theorists. You know, we don't do empirical political science research. And so I think one of the ways that theorists tend to differentiate themselves is in their writing. And so they take writing as a skill very seriously. And so I think that's been as important to my writing about baseball as anything else, but sort of a hodgepodge.
That would be another long conversation, yeah. I would love to have, although I think when it comes to both Hobbes and Foucault, I'm probably vastly outclassed.
Oh, I don't know about that. I am a PhD dropout, so maybe we would be very similarly classed.
Well, so am I, but on the history side, baseball writing just was so lucrative that I couldn't resist the pull away from academia.
My mom's like, oh, I'm glad you went to grad school for this.
I don't know what your experience was like, but part of what happened to me was I would go in and every day somebody in authority would say to me, you know, you're just running up debt. You're never going to make any money.
Yeah.
There are no jobs out there. You're going to have this PhD and you're going to have six figures in debt. Do you know what my resume says? My resume says self-employed for five of the last 6 years. But you know what I was really doing? Watching the soaps and being supported by my wife because you can't make money with a history degree. And I finally just said, okay.
Yeah, I wanted to be in Seattle and there are just not a lot of jobs. And so I decided to be in Seattle instead of Lubbock or Tuscaloosa or whatever, you know, satellite campus in Wisconsin would hire me. And so that was a lot of it for me. Plus I kept wanting to talk about baseball and they were like, well, we're not doing that today. I'm like, but can't we? There's a lot of politics here. this is fruitful ground if we want to make it that.
It's all history. It's all politics. It expresses itself in a different way. And it's a cliche to say that it's a microcosm of American society, but it's true.
Yeah. And then there's a home run. You know, it lets you breathe in between those things, which I think is an underrated part of it, is it forces you to confront a lot of those issues and grapple with them. But it also is entertainment and it is drama and sorrow and silliness. And it's all of those things. And so I think those are important sort of beats that let people take in and bite off as much of the serious stuff as they want to and then take a break to have a fun time in between. So
I can't think of a better note to close on. Meg, thank you so much for dropping by and having this conversation with me. I had a great time.
Well, thanks for having me. This was fun.
By Atticus's spectacles, we've reached the end of another show. Meg Rowley can be followed on Twitter at Meg Rowler, that's L-E-R instead of L-E-Y. It reads kind of like me growler, and to the extent I've gotten to know her during this interview, I suspect that might be intentional. You can read her work at Baseball Prospectus, and you can watch the Celebrating Women on Baseball panel at the Seattle Mariners Facebook page on the video tab. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because when I went by Grab Stephen Goldman, the bruises I got whenever I walked down the street were terrible. You can also write in at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And please, as always, rate us at the podcasting service of your choice, iTunes or what have you. It really is appreciated. As James Cagney said in Yankee Doodle Dandy, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you. We have a sponsor now, but nonetheless, this episode is still brought to you by the number 34. Our producer has been mixing this show on a 1935 Spartan 558 sled radio, which explains so much, but I can't argue with him. It's so pretty. Our theme song, The Infinite Man, was co-written by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. When I was Rick's best man, I gave a rather long toast, and when I sat down, another good friend said, you know, it wasn't a very good toast, but it's not your fault. We just overestimated you as a writer and set the bar too high. Later, his drunk uncle told me that it was just something he had to sit through, like a funeral or my daughter's tuba recital. I always have thought of myself as a member of the family. Well, if things are only half as bad as five times the amount of foreboding I have about two-thirds of the state of things, then I'm 99% likely to be back next week. with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.